Hub
and Spoke Audio Collective.
The future is shaped by technology,
but technology is shaped by us.
You're listening to Soonish. I'm Wade Rausch. It's Halloween, and do I have a scary story for you? This comes straight from the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. Part of that report looked at the computer systems that state election agencies use to store voter records. In July of 2016, hackers affiliated with the GRU, Russia's Military Foreign Intelligence Service, scanned these computer systems in all 50 states. One witness told the committee that the activity was like, quote,
"Somebody walking down the street and looking to see if you're home. A small number of systems were unsuccessfully exploited, as though somebody had rattled the doorknob, but was unable to get in. However, a small number of the networks were successfully exploited. They made it through the door."
One of those doors was at the Illinois Board of Elections, where cyber attackers were able to break in and steal voter registration data. They got names, addresses, birth dates, driver's license numbers, and parts of the social security numbers for up to 200,000 Illinois voters. The hackers got so far inside the Illinois system that they could have deleted or altered actual voter data. And you can imagine what kind of chaos that might have caused when people showed up and tried to vote on election day. But for reasons nobody understands, they didn't change any data. They just kind of rummaged around. A witness from the Department of Homeland Security told the Senate committee that the Russian hackers
almost certainly could have done more. Why they didn't is sort of an open-ended question. I think it fits under the larger umbrella of undermining confidence in the election by tipping their hand that they had this level of access, or showing that they were capable of getting it.
And even after the 2016 elections that brought Donald Trump to power, the break-in attempts continued. Spear phishing attacks, SQL injection, denial of service attacks. Hackers used all of them to target election infrastructure in the run-up to the 2018 midterms. Homeland Security officials say that multiple elements of U.S. election infrastructure are still vulnerable today to cyber intrusions. And the intruders who were just casing the joint last time around could cause a lot more damage next time. And here's another scary fact. The electronic voting machines that many states use are disturbingly vulnerable to hacking. The Senate Intelligence Committee brought in a University of Michigan computer scientist and election technology expert named J. Alex Halderman. And here's what Halderman said.
"We've studied touchscreen and optical scan systems. And in every single case, we found ways for attackers to sabotage machines and to steal votes. These capabilities are certainly within reach for America's enemies."
A lot of states use voting machines that leave a paper record. And in those states, the paper ballots give officials a way to audit elections after the fact and detect vote stealing. But almost a quarter of the states are still using machines that don't produce paper trails. The 2020 U.S. national elections are just over a year away. And there's a battle going on in Congress over whether to hold President Trump accountable for his attempts to get a foreign government to influence those elections by smearing his opponent, Joe Biden. So things are tense. But here's the real nightmare scenario. At a time when politics is already extremely polarized, we can't even be 100% confident that the voting process will work the way it's supposed to next November. I'm not talking about people trying to vote in places where they're not registered. That's an obsession of President Trump's, but the problem is so rare that it's virtually non-existent. I'm talking about Russia or other adversaries tampering with the elections just enough to make people wonder whether the winner in 2020 really won.
I think sometimes we just assume that the only thing that needs to be secured is the voting mechanism, the device itself.
That's Earl Matthews. He's a retired major general who formerly directed cyber operations and information security for the United States Air Force.
When we look at it from a practitioner standpoint, there are three major areas that make up the whole entire election system. First, you have the voting machine, the software, the hardware, but then you also have the election administration, right? So the voter databases. And then the third part of this is really kind of the national side, which are the election campaigns, not only by the individual, but you have news organizations, you have the political parties, we have a lot of social media platforms, and then we have the PACs and donor groups. All of those make up what I would consider the election system for us in the U.S., and all of those are going to get targeted at different times.
These days, General Matthews has a job as the chief strategy officer for a computer security company called Veridin. And he says there are things that all the players involved in U.S. elections could be doing to make their systems more secure. One step would be for election agencies to act more like real businesses and to keep their software up to date.
What we've long said is that if we could just get cyber hygiene under control, we would knock down 85% of what we have to deal with every day from a security perspective. And now we can focus our resources on that other 15% that really matter. So cyber hygiene comes down to, do I actually have my security controls, my products configured like they're supposed to? Have I applied every patch that needs to be applied? And have we communicated every time that we've made a change to the network? So we're basically automating cyber hygiene.
So cyber hygiene is sort of like changing the locks on your building and making sure everybody has the right key. And the states are about to get a little more money to stay more hygienic. Back in 2018, Democrats in Congress proposed spending an extra $250 million to help states replace outdated voting machines and invest in better cybersecurity. But then they were blocked for more than a year by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Finally, proponents of the new security spending started calling him Moscow Mitch. The unspoken insult was that McConnell seemed to be okay with foreign interference in U.S. elections as long as it benefited Republicans. In September, McConnell finally broke down and endorsed the new spending. But in the larger election system that General Matthews was talking about, we've got problems that even $250 million for better cyber hygiene won't fix. Like disinformation campaigns that could deceive voters, or suppression tactics that could keep them away from the polls. So that's the big question for today's episode. Can we imagine a future where elections are free, fair, and trustworthy? Or are we basically screwed? Since it's Halloween, some of the news is going to be frightening. But there's also some hope. And to start, I want to tell you the story of a startup here in my hometown of Boston that's working to make it safe and easy for all of us to vote using the machines we've already got in our pockets. That is, our smartphones. This story actually starts in India in 1984, when the country was locked in a brutal cycle of violence. For years, Sikh separatists had been trying to set up an autonomous Sikh state in the Indian state of Punjab. That year, armed Sikh militants took refuge in Punjab's Golden Temple, one of the holiest sites in the Sikh religion. India's Prime Minister, Indira Gandhi, launched an operation to remove the militants from the temple, resulting in hundreds of casualties on both sides. Most Sikhs saw the operation against the Golden Temple as a pogrom, and on October 31st, 1984, in fact, 35 years ago today, the Prime Minister's Sikh bodyguards took revenge by assassinating Gandhi herself. And the assassination triggered even more trauma. In 4 days of anti-Sikh riots in Delhi, at least 3,000 Sikhs were killed, and tens of thousands more were displaced.
And there were a lot of people who were killed, and houses were burned, and bad things like that.
That's Nimit Sawhney. He comes from a Sikh family in India.
And soon after that, there were elections for the new prime minister. And during that process, ended up seeing people being forced to vote at gunpoint.
What Sawhney's talking about here is the strategy of coercion that India's ruling Congress Party adopted in Punjab and other places to shore up support for its new leader, Rajiv Gandhi, the son of Indira Gandhi.
And so that kind of stuck in my head as something really bad. And so we kind of grew up not having a very positive opinion of government and elections.
Sawhney went on to study computer science. After he moved to the U.S., he developed a special expertise in mobile payment systems. And in 2014, he and some colleagues were in Austin, Texas, for South by Southwest. And they found out about a programming contest called Hack to the Future. One of the prizes in this contest was a funny thing called a Bitcoin.
So we were very intrigued why somebody would offer a Bitcoin as a prize. This was the pre-hype days, so not many people knew much about it, and we certainly didn't. So we ended up reading the paper and getting pretty fascinated the morning of, and we decided to participate. What really stood out was the potential for using this for a data security mechanism. We weren't too enamored by the money side of it initially. And so the use case which came to mind was how to prevent coercion in a remote voting scenario.
In other words, all this time, Sani had been thinking about whether it might be possible to use technology to make the kind of voter coercion that he'd witnessed in India impossible. And the Bitcoin Prize at South by Southwest inspired Sani's team to think about whether they could use the blockchain technology behind Bitcoin to finally do it. Sani and his team ended up winning the hackathon and the Bitcoin. And what came out of that about 1 year later was a new startup called Votes. That's spelled V-O-A-T-Z, which, annoyingly, sounds exactly like the word votes. So just stick with me, and when I'm using the company's name, I'll try to make it clear from the context. Today, Votes is 4 years old, and its mission is to let people vote in local, state, and national elections using just the screens of their iPhones or Android phones without ever having to go to a polling place. The company started small by pilot testing the app in state party conventions and town meetings. But step by step, they've been expanding to elections with more people and greater consequences. In 2018, the company got a big break when the state of West Virginia hired them to collect votes remotely from military officers and civilians serving abroad. That's a group that's had notoriously low turnout in previous elections, basically because it's so difficult to get an absentee ballot and then return it in time to be counted.
When we looked at the number of people who vote in that demographic, it was like 7%, which was shocking because many of them are serving the country. Arguably, they have the first right to vote, and we have made it the hardest for them to vote. And so we felt like that would be a good demographic. Similarly, the disability community, then students who are away from their homes and are not able to vote the traditional way, then potentially every absentee voter, and then maybe everybody else. But each of these phases needs to be done carefully, kind of baby step way, step by step, evaluate, make sure you're confirming the security, building the trust, doing the post-election audits.
So they're taking it slow for now. But Sani says the company's long-term ambition is to put smartphone voting technology into the hands of anyone who wants to vote that way.
Long term, yes, we would definitely hope that every citizen gets the choice. It still needs to be a choice, because if you like to vote in person and go to the polling station and do it on paper, I think you should still have that choice. And eventually everybody has that choice, and they can decide whichever way they feel comfortable voting, which is kind of akin to how we live our lives. Eventually, if we are doing everything on our phones, then it would make sense that we want to vote on our phones as well.
Now, smart listener that you are, I can already hear the questions piling up in your head. If it's so easy for Alex Halderman and his research team at Michigan to find ways to sabotage our existing electronic voting machines, how could it possibly be safe to let people vote on their smartphones? And how does all of this relate back to blockchain technology and preventing coercion of the kind that Sani witnessed in India? Well, buckle up, because with Nimit Sani's help, I'm about to explain the whole process of voting on the Votes app. By the end, I think you'll agree that the technology isn't all that radical. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's safer than the election systems we currently use in the U.S.
Let's say that I'm a military officer in Afghanistan or something, and I have an iPhone or an Android phone. Walk me through how my vote gets from my phone all the way to the election commissioner in my home county in West Virginia.
Sure. So your first step is very similar to what you would ordinarily do, even if our system didn't exist, which is register as a absentee voter. At that point, they add you to a list of eligible voters on the Votes platform, you will then receive a notification to download the app on your iPhone or Android device. And the first thing you do is you use your mobile number and email to sign up for an anonymous account. And then you proceed to do an identity verification process. So it'll prompt you to take a picture of a government-issued photo ID. You can use a driver's license, state ID, or passport. And then the system will prompt you to take a live selfie. It's a live video selfie, so it does a liveness check to make sure that it is you and you're not taking a picture of a picture or a picture of another video. It'll then do facial recognition matching to the picture you took, to the picture on the ID you provided, to make sure it's the real person and you're not using somebody else's ID.
Long story short, the election agency back home makes sure that your ID matches up with their voter registration data. And then the app sends a credential to your phone that can only be unlocked using a biometric input, like your fingerprint or your face.
And at that point, you're ready to receive your ballot. So soon after that, you get another notification saying, here's your ballot, mobile ballot, which is basically the exact ballot you would have gotten at your precinct if you went to vote in person. So then you mark the ballot on the screen, just like you would on paper. You mark the ovals. And then when you are ready to submit, the system shows you a digital receipt. So you can make sure that if you marked overlay, the system got overlay. And then it prompts you again to provide a biometric credential, which would be your fingerprint, face ID, touch ID, or whatever other mechanism you're using. And then it anonymizes your ballot and sends it off to the network. And then you also receive at that point a secured, digitally signed receipt, which has the information about the ovals you marked. Your jurisdiction receives an anonymized copy of that receipt in a separate logbox.
Now, this is where blockchain comes in. Blockchain-based systems like Bitcoin or Votes can be complicated in execution, but the basic idea is pretty simple. A blockchain is like a digital record book or ledger with lots of copies. It's easy to add data to the record, but once the data is there, nobody can alter it without getting caught. In the system that Sonny's team built, every oval that you mark gets stored anonymously as a separate record on the blockchain. And here we need to pause for a quick side note. Before your vote goes into the lockbox, you have the opportunity to throw out your original ballot. In the elections world, that's called spoiling a ballot. And it happens all the time in regular polling places, when people mark the wrong ovals by accident. But there's another reason you might want to spoil your first ballot.
Obviously, coercion of the kind we were thinking of doesn't really happen as commonly in the US. It does happen very frequently in other parts of the world. And so the system we envision does have that provision. So if you as a voter are feeling threatened, maybe you are in your workspace or at home or wherever you are, if you feel any kind of threat, then it does give you a way so that you can proceed normally, and so the person who's trying to threaten you wouldn't be able to know and would seem like everything's normal, and then later on you can come back and, you know, vote again. So basically in that scenario, cast your ballot as a provisional ballot and then you can come back and do it when you are in a safer location. We hope nobody ever needs to use that feature in the system, but it's there.
Okay. Let's assume that you filled in the ovals correctly and your vote wasn't coerced. Your vote gets added to the blockchain and stored in the digital lockbox.
And then on election day, your jurisdiction unlocks the lockbox and they actually print the paper ballot based off your cast ovals. That's then tabulated.
Let's pause again on that point because it's really interesting and important. What Sonny is saying is that the votes you submitted on your phone get turned into printed ballots, just like the ones filled out by people who voted in person at the polling place. Then those ballots get run through traditional optical scanners. Only then do your votes get counted as part of the actual election.
So we don't do the counting. The jurisdiction does the counting, just like they currently do, because it's all paper. They're tabulated in the standard tabulation machines. So we felt like that was a good step to show that even a very modern system can integrate with a legacy infrastructure. So we are not increasing the work of the election officials, we're actually making it easier and more efficient for them.
Another beautiful thing about having a paper ballot is that you can do an audit after the election, where you compare all the digital receipts from the blockchain to the paper ballots and make sure everyone's vote was counted.
So now for the first time, you've managed to have an end-to-end verifiable system, which right from the voter side, who are able to verify their vote, to now the jurisdiction being able to make sure that voter intent was honored, and that anonymously now we are able to audit the whole election. And so that is the whole end-to-end process.
It sounds as if there is at least equal and perhaps more verification and security built into that process than there would be at a typical neighborhood polling place on election day. Can you compare the two?
Yes, definitely. There's way more verification steps here, because on most occasions, in most jurisdictions, when you go to vote in person, they really don't ask you for an ID. All they might do is ask you for your name and the street address where you live in, and then they'll put a check mark against your name. Theoretically, you could pretend to be your neighbor who doesn't ever vote, and you could cast a fake ballot. And so there is very little verification, and this system definitely has many more layers of verification. Given that it's a remote system, we feel it's necessary, because we need to be 100% sure that you are who you say you are.
Now, like I said, Votes the Company is starting small. The 2018 pilot test in West Virginia only involved 144 voters. The company went on to run remote voting for county and city elections in Denver, Colorado. And as we speak, the system's being used for absentee voting in municipal elections in four jurisdictions in Utah. As cool as it would be if we could all vote on our smartphones, it probably makes sense for votes to grow in baby steps, especially when there are still so many skeptics who think smartphone voting might be unsafe. One of those skeptics is Joseph Lorenzo Hall. He's the chief technologist at a think tank called the Center for Democracy and Technology. And he told Vanity Fair that he thinks votes as technology is, quote, a horrifically bad idea, unquote. Hall said he's mainly scared that at some point in the future, it might be possible to decrypt someone's vote and tie it back to their identity. That's not actually possible, since the votes system doesn't store identity information once a vote's been cast and added to the blockchain. Now, of course, there are legitimate questions about what kinds of technology we want to adopt for future elections. One persistent criticism of votes and other private for-profit election technology companies is that they aren't transparent enough, meaning they haven't shared the source code behind their systems in a way that would give outside software experts a chance to evaluate it. What Nimit Sawhney says in reply is that the company does share its source code, but only with clients who've signed confidentiality agreements. He also argues that the lack of transparency at votes is actually part of what keeps the system safe. It's a concept called security by obscurity.
This is the fundamental argument we are making, that the technology to make this safe enough is here, and that's why we are doing it, and we are trying to continuously make it better and stay ahead of the adversary. And so, just like in a military scenario, you don't reveal your secrets to the adversary for them to expect that we will reveal all our secrets to the public and just make it easier for our adversary to find a way to attack us, it doesn't make any sense.
In the end, if votes wants to succeed, it will have to gain the trust of state and local election agencies. And whether it does that through obscurity or through transparency is probably less important than just showing bit by bit that the system works for real elections with results that can be publicly audited. And that's exactly what the company is busy doing. But there's one final design decision baked into votes as technology that could be seen as problematic. And this one is kind of obvious, but you do have to have a smartphone to vote using votes.
Let me start by saying that I don't actually have a smartphone. So that would be my first reaction, would be, this is excluding me. And okay, I don't have a smartphone by choice, but there are people who can't afford smartphones because those things are expensive.
This is Malka Older. She's a sociologist and an international aid worker. and she's also the author of a fantastic trilogy of science fiction thrillers called The Sentinel Cycle. The books describe a world in the near future where national borders have dissolved, and people sort themselves into micro-democracies called sentinels.
It kind of takes away the geographic link with politics, and voting is extremely easy and allowed for everyone. Voting is done on personal devices, and the other key factor of this is this big international bureaucracy, which is, you can think of as sort of a combination of the UN and Google, which is entirely dedicated to information management and exists basically on the principle that you cannot have a functioning democracy, a properly functioning democracy, without access to good information.
The three books in the Sentinel Cycle are called Infomocracy, Null States, and State Tectonics. And the reason I like them so much is that, like all good science fiction, they make us think harder about the world we live in now. Melka asks what kind of social, political, and technological changes we could make right now that would help democracies function better. So it's not the case that Melka thinks voting on your smartphone is a bad idea. In fact, she thinks it might be better than traditional voting for some people. Her point is just that technology can only be part of the solution for fixing elections.
There are a lot of reasons for us to be concerned about in-person voting in terms of the way it's used for voter suppression, in terms of, you know, people who are working jobs that don't let them get away, in terms of people who are have mobility issues and can't get physically to the polls. And, you know, we're seeing states, some states address that to a certain extent. They have early voting, they have voting by mail. And again, you know, none of these solutions are going to be completely perfect. We can certainly do a lot better than we're doing now. And I think that safe e-voting, you know, would be great if we can make sure that it's both safe and auditable. I mean, I really like the auditable component of this. But, you know, it's still going to require a lot of effort and a lot of people involved to keep it safe once it's set up. And I tend to think of it more in terms of systems than in terms of technology. I think the technology is really important and can do a lot for us. But, you know, I'm also thinking very much in terms of systems, and I'm very resistant to the idea of some perfect system that's going to fix everything. I don't think that happens. And I think that we as a society and as people change too fast for that to stick, even if it did happen momentarily. So, you know, I think it's really important for us to realize that we have to keep interacting with the systems we create. We have to keep monitoring them and running them and improving them. You know, I think there's this very dangerous feeling that we have a democracy, we're done, and that's not remotely the case.
There's one big thing that ties together my conversations with General Earl Matthews at Veriden and Nimit Sawhney at Votes and Malka Older. It's that all three of them think of elections as systems. And if we can achieve better cyber hygiene and get the technology part of elections working better, then it is possible to imagine a future where more people can vote without fear of tampering or coercion. But all three of my guests say there's one last part of the election system that's in very poor health.
What really worries me, one thing, is the misinformation campaign which happens on social media. I think that is a problem which is the hardest problem to solve. And I think while we can be very sure that it's really, really hard to alter a vote or change a vote, regardless of whichever system you're using, it's a lot easier to convince people that something bad happened by just spreading bad information. And so I think that's what we as citizens and officials need to be very, very careful about.
And what actually bothers me most and keeps me awake at night in regards to election is social media and disinformation being able to be so quickly disseminated, not only leading up to the election, but even on the day of election, where somebody could theoretically post on social media a bunch of misinformation or even disinformation about what was happening with the elections, and that might dissuade people from not even going to the polling booths.
What General Matthews just said there echoes something I recently heard from another former national security official, Her name is Juliette Kayyem, and you may remember her from my July episode called How to Fix Social Media. Kayyem teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and she served as Assistant Secretary for Intergovernmental Affairs in the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. And here's what she said in that July episode.
So if you ask me as a counterterrorism and national security person, what would I do if I were the Russians? How do I win if I want Trump to win? I suppressed 20,000 African-American votes in Michigan and I've won. How do I do this? I don't do it the same way I did it before. I'm going to bring down a couple critical infrastructures. I'm going to do fake news that there is an active shooter and maybe one other thing. The social media platforms have got to get their act together on the use of their platforms to create fake news that impacts the ability of people to actually do the physical act of voting.
So that is the real Halloween horror story. It doesn't help the situation that Facebook and Fox News and conservative talk radio have walked away from the notion that they have any responsibility to verify the truth of the information on their platforms. But if there is a final ray of hope here, it may be that the internet and social media are still relatively young. Malka Older thinks that, over the long term, societies usually figure out how to adapt to disruptive new communications technologies and how to make sure that their power doesn't fall into the hands of a malicious few. Here's one last bit from our talk.
You see that there's a lot of influence in our elections, and it's a big problem. And I'm sure it's going to be very problematic this time as well. And I suspect that if you look back at the other times when major communications technology revolutions happened. So like when television became popular, when radio became popular before that, when books and the printing press became popular, you know, at each of these, they've gone through different phases in terms of being captured by the elite, having a lot of license in terms of what they propagate, and people not really knowing how to deal with that. Right now, we're in a place where the potential for disinformation of social media is just exploding. The people who do have, you know, the power, who have the money, you know, who have the savvy to figure out how to play on the particular kinds of virality that work really well in social media are having a field day right now. And, you know, I think slowly the understanding and the literacy about this media and what is easily faked and what can be believed and how you can evaluate the information you get from it, I think will slowly build up among the population in general. But right now we're in a very dangerous place in terms of that.
Yeah, I mean, even if we had completely fair and trustworthy elections, we still have politicians who feel like it's to their advantage to cast doubt on the system sometimes, and that makes it even harder.
I mean, legitimacy is this incredibly fragile sort of collective agreement about things, about what works, right? What is legitimate? What is something that we believe in? You know, whether you're talking about the value of paper money or whether you're talking about democracy, it's very fragile and it's very much dependent on people kind of agreeing to believe in things. And it's very easy to break parts of that. And I think that's another big reason why our voter turnout in this country is relatively low, is because a lot of people have been taught over and over again that their votes really don't matter. So, you know, we need to really look seriously at our institutions, and we need to ideally decide as a country whether we do actually believe in democracy and implement it.
Soonish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. Our opening theme music is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. All of the other music in this episode comes from the fine folks at Title Card Music and Sound in Boston. You can follow the show on Twitter at Soonish Podcast. You can find the show notes and the transcript for this episode at our website, soonishpodcast.org. And if you'd like to donate to the show, you can do that at patreon.com/soonish. Every dollar helps to keep this one-man independent podcast alive. Speaking of independent podcasts, Soonish is a proud founding member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of smart, idea-driven shows. And there's been so much news at Hub and Spoke this fall. We've added 3 new shows to the collective, and right now I want to tell you about just one of them. It's called Open Source, and it's executive produced by Mary McGrath and hosted by one of my real journalism heroes, Christopher Lydon. Every week, Chris talks with brilliant figures from the worlds of art, politics, and ideas, like Matt Stoller, who talked last week about how monopolies are eroding democracy. The show isn't just a romp through important ideas. For me, it's also a masterclass in how to do a great on-air interview. You can listen in at radioopensource.org. You can find all of the Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with a new episode soonish.